Ahoy, hoy, everybody. Welcome to yet another episode of Talk to the Audience. This is our Talking Simpsons Patreon exclusive comments and feedback show, and a little bit of news mixed in there as well. That's a great description, by the way. I came up with that off the top of my head. I'm Bob Mackey. I usually host this thing. And who else is here with me?
Henry Gilbert. And I am slightly queasy after watching something we're about to talk about.
Yes. So thanks again for donating, everybody. I did want to say I met a lot of people at the Portland Retro Gaming Expo. I go there every year. I'll be there next year if I survive 2017 and 2018.
We made it this far.
Yeah, we never know what's going to happen with Rocket Man. But I met a lot of people. People are asking, like, where's Henry? Where's Laser Time? And when are you guys going to do a panel for Talking Simpsons? And I think we're working on it. I do want to do one... within the next year, I'm pretty sure we might be able to find a venue.
I think by the end of 2018, we maybe could. There's more and more podcast conventions every year, but it's tougher in that, like, well, what are we going to do the podcast at? Like, it's not a gaming show, so we couldn't really... I guess we could fit in at PAX. I bet we'd get a lot of Simpsons likers at PAX.
I think so.
Or a similar convention. I don't want to just say PAX.
There's lots of conventions. But yeah, this has been a really busy month for me. I had a Retronauts recording, and I had to get ready for Portland Retro Gaming Expo. This is the first year that we had a booth, so there was a lot going on with that. So I'm finally happy to be done with all of that stuff and get ready to catch up with some Talking Simpsons stuff. Like, we actually are going to start posting the... if you listen to our last episode, we told everybody that the Laser Time main Talking Simpsons feed only holds 100 episodes. So as time goes by, more episodes fall off that feed. They're still available on the website, but that is not the ideal way to listen to them. So very soon we will start uploading them probably once a week, I think, or maybe two a week until we catch up. Not all at once, though. Give you guys just, you won't look down at your podcast device and see it's downloading 30 podcasts and wondering what happened.
Yes, but also, yeah, I'll take some of the blame for that.
This is just to call you out, Henry.
No, I know.
Asleep at the switch again.
Well, I meant to, you know, I also wanted to at least remove the ads from them too before we uploaded them, and just give them a slight change up. But also, yeah, I was on a big trip this month too.
That's right. Yeah, we all had our own trips.
I went to New York Comic Con, and it was not fun.
Nope.
But
it all paid off in the end in some way. I mean, we at least got to interview Ian Jones Quarty.
Yeah, Ian Jones Quarty. We got to talk to him. I had hoped to meet up with him at New York Comic Con, but I mean, I guess he's busy with like some cartoon show or something, so he didn't have time. I understand. I totally understand. But he was super awesome in our interview. But before we talk about that, I just want to say at New York Comic Con, there were a couple really cool things that happened on top of like bad things that happened. For one thing, not only did I get to go and see, you know, Ian Jones Quarty's panel, which was really cool, and the Steven Universe panel, which was really awesome. Like, they just sang live songs, which
was great.
But for Simpsons fans, the coolest part was I got to go to the Stand Against Evil press room, which I recorded a tiny thing at, which I actually am going to like just plug into the end of this episode. I got to ask one question of Dana Gould. Couldn't even ask. I was like, oh, let me ask him about Gex, but like the PR person just took him away.
Aww.
I gave him an old business card that I wrote my current email on. I was like, please, I just want to talk to you about Gex. And he's like, yeah, sure. And then he just left. I was like, yeah, I'm not.
That was a dark time in my life, Henry.
He always talks about Gex.
It's true.
He talks about how Ron Helge and him wrote Gex stuff and how much he loves Ron Helge.
He informally agreed to be on a Retronauts about Gex.
Yeah.
Let's see if that ever happens.
I mean, again, he's making his own TV show, so he shouldn't be busy.
Yeah.
Like, that's. But anyway.
And he's a working comic, too. So.
So I did get to ask him a Simpson question, but the biggest moment for me was... So first off, and Janet Varning was there. She was really cool. John C. McGinley was there, and he was being a very actory man, and he was cool. But then... I look out of the corner of my eye. I'm like, oh, who's this guy in a rugby shirt and khakis who just walked in, this older man? And I looked at him for like two more seconds. And I was like, is that Mike Reese? And then Dana Gould walked over to him and started chatting with him. I was like, motherfucker, that's Mike Reese. I am within 5 feet of Mike Reese and his wife. And then look, Dana Gould was in a public space. It was not eavesdropping on it, but he was just saying that they were going to go to get lunch together. And if I had, I don't know, maybe I should have been like, Mr. Reese, you're so cool. But I'd actually already been kind of emailing with Mike Reese, and he was very uninterested in a podcast interview this year, he said. So
he's too busy with his off-Broadway musical?
Yeah, his musical, I Hate Musicals. But so that's also why he's in New York right now. So, but that was, at the very least, I got to be party to a Simpsons writers reunion of Dana Gould and Mike Reese meeting up, though they never intersected. Mike Reese never worked on an episode with Dana Gould. They're just comedy buddies.
Was Dana Gould starting in like season 13?
Dana Gould was like 13, I think he was. And so and Reese was done with his partnership with Gene then, though of course, as our as some of our interviews have revealed, they're all friends. Like, friends hire friends.
That's right.
But anyway, yes. Yeah, so that was New York. But the Ian interview, yeah, that really turned out great, I think. The Cartoon Network, got to give thumbs up to the PR person at Cartoon Network for also helping us set it up. They didn't have to, and we got a whole hour with him on the
phone. That was great. It was great just to talk to him, actually. Yeah. Not as a even just as a superstar, but just on as a fellow nerd, you know, because he grew up in the same era we did. He was into the same cartoons we are, the same video games. So it was fun to just be like, wow, this mega talented semi-famous person he's just like us.
Yes, he's just like, but it was just like us. Like, oh yeah, I had that memory in the 90s too. Like, I think that's too why he's such a fan of Retronauts as well as Talking Simpsons. Of just like, he
did he call us his favorite podcast on Twitter?
He did.
It was his favorite or one of his favorites? It's very important.
Might have been one.
We'll have to check the records.
But I mean, he also, yeah, he promoted it to all his fans, and yeah, it was. I hope we got some new listeners as well from that. So if you are a new listener, thanks.
Yeah, but thanks a lot. So I guess we have some Simpsons news to talk about.
So every time we do this, we try to go over any major Simpsons news that happened in the month, since we're not really that topical on the regular show. But perhaps in response to the recent stuff about gender and the Simpsons staff, but also because she is an amazing, funny writer, Megan Amram just got hired as a staff writer for season 29 of The Simpsons, which that's a year from now you'll be seeing it. But
I know her most from how she trolls awful men on Twitter with jokes.
Yeah, she's really good at that. Twitter. Yeah. She's written for tons of great shows, and yeah, she's so funny. I also love that her Twitter avatar is one of the best. Like, yes, it is her making the ugliest face she can.
Like slamming her chin down into her neck.
Yeah. So I think she's a great fit for The Simpsons. It's kind of like, if The Simpsons could hire more people who didn't go to Harvard with Al Jean, and maybe like younger people who wrote things. I don't want to get super negative on Al Jean, but I do think, like, he's had 16 years now in charge of the show since he returned. Like, maybe a new showrunner.
Yeah, I don't think that will ever change.
I really don't think so. Well, that also reminds me, though, Al Jean was a key part to, I haven't watched it yet, but the Homer at the Bat, like, documentary.
Oh, I need to watch that.
Yeah, I haven't watched it yet either. They obviously filmed a lot of it while they were at the Baseball Hall of Fame special presentation for Homer at the Bat, which turned 25 this year.
Oh, it's so old.
Yeah. Oh, God, I know. And, well, I saw people resurfacing their articles that they wrote for the 20th anniversary. I was like, Jesus Christ, huh? Time sucks.
It really does.
And then, lastly, in Simpsons news, there was some controversy about a segment in the newest Treehouse of Horror. Bob and I haven't watched all of the episode, but we did watch this segment.
Yes,
Homer.
And I think I have a higher tolerance for this than Henry, but Henry was not a fan of this. So Homer, in the episode, he runs out of food. Marge leaves with the family to go to Lima, Ohio, which they say Lima in the episode. And I know it's Lima because we're all hicks and we don't say the words the right way. But he runs out of food, and he starts eating parts of himself. And I think what makes it even grosser is that just the specificity of what he's doing. Like, he's cutting off fingers and toes. Like, yes, if he just lopped off an arm in the episode, I don't think it would have been as extreme as just like, I'm going to slowly cut off my finger.
Yeah, just the piece by piece of it of like, well, I can just cut off another finger and another finger. I'll cut off my toes. It gets sillier when he cuts off his own foot or his full leg and is just cooking the leg. But it's like just seeing him like slowly disappear.
I don't know if you've ever seen the series Tim and Eric's Bedtime Stories. They're really great modern Twilight Zone episodes that are a mix of comedy and horror. But But one of the grossest ones I can't rewatch, and they're not as gross as what Tim and Eric usually do, but yeah. Bob Odenkirk plays a cosmetic surgeon who just removes toes. So in this episode, toe removal is like a cosmetic surgery you get. Ugh. And you don't actually, I think there's one shot of him cutting off toes, but mostly it's just him struggling with like garden shears, like, like just cutting off the toes. Yuck. So I think, I'm sorry if I'm grossing out our listeners at home, but the cutting off fingers and toes is more extreme just to think about than like losing an arm or a leg.
Homer's head in, yeah. I would have been less gross than just him. It's bloodless, which makes it weirder, I'd say. But Homer,
he's like a big cold cut or something.
Yes, yeah, it's yuck.
But I think David Merkin would be proud because the episode, the Treehouse of Horror episode we recently covered is the most violent one to date in the show. It's the Inside Out gas one. It's the you know, teachers eating the children one.
I think it's something they learned of like, well, we can be gross, but not bloody. Like, that's Merkins were hella bloody. But yeah, it's just giving me like, it's grossing me out and thinking about it.
I think in the episode Trilogy of Error, doesn't Homer lose his finger in that episode?
He cuts off a thumb, they are able to reattach
that it. That was gross.
That was really gross.
Yeah, that was gross. Because,
he didn't eat it then, but also just seeing his finger get cooked. And then I did like, though, I had a nerdy continuity question watching it, and then the show answered it.
Yeah, like, why are they getting all this meat off of Homer? And Lenny answers the question.
Yes, yeah. Though, man, Lenny had to pay big time to get Homer's skull as a cup to drink.
Really?
You think
they make like gelatin desserts out of that?
I did read that Al Jean replied to questions of why was this so disgusting? And he said, like, well, people are asking for us to make scary Halloween segments, so we made one.
I think they're really just rising to meet the level of other animated shows. Like, every other contemporary animated show gets really gross, like the new show Big Mouth, F is for Family, Rick and Morty gets really gross. So I think they're just like, oh, this is what animated shows are now. We have to do this gross stuff, too.
I'm not going to watch Big Mouth.
It's honestly not as bad as what people are saying.
I love it.
I just wish
the
designs weren't hideous.
I love Nick Kroll. I love John Mulaney. I love all the actors in it and the writers. But the problem is that it looks hideous. Like, it looks like less. They're like, well, we're not as good as Seth MacFarlane. Let's not draw as good as those designs. Like, it just looks bad. I hate. Cartoons can look better than that.
I agree. I don't like the designs. They move a lot better than I assume they would. I think it's not as flashy as it could be in terms of flash animation.
Which we go into a little bit in that interview with Ian, which I think he worked around it very well of just saying, like, in my opinion, this is the way I like to do it. He's not... I'm sure he knows people who work on all those other shows. He's like, yeah, it's kind of a budget thing. Like, I would bet OKKO costs a lot more than BoJack Horseman does.
There are better and worse ways to do the flashy animation, too. Like, F is for Family is flash, but they go to great lengths to make it look like a traditional animated show. BoJack Horseman is really ugly. It doesn't move well, but it's not about... It's a radio play. It's not about the animation, really, at all.
When I watch season 4 and then watch a season 1 episode, I'm like, well, you guys at least got better at this. Like, you got better at hiding the flashing. By the way, slightly off topic, but did you see the news about anime and Netflix and how Netflix may be saving anime?
No, actually, I know, like, they greenlit a record number of series and they help fund stuff like Little Witch Academia and things like that, but
In general, this was a really cool article I read in the Hollywood Reporter. Netflix as overall is going to spend $8 billion on original content in the next year, which is just like, Jesus Christ. But like, hey, if you're going to spend that on making new things and new art, that's better than a lot of ways to invest $8 billion. But it's just a crazy number.
Yeah.
And part of that is going into anime because they've seen that original anime does well for them.
It's heartening as an animation fan to see that because it's so many companies, executives would be like, what's this anime crap? Who watches this crap? But it's like, no, this stuff is huge and it's never been a better time to watch it for its audience.
And Netflix has the numbers to know, oh, people are watching this. And so the article went on to talk about how the model in Japan is crazy for making anime, that it is like why animation people in the Japanese industry are making garbage money, like less than $1,000 a month in some cases.
It's a tough life.
To work to death. But then also, like, the model is crazy too for most television animation. You start in the red and you then want to make people buy your Blu-rays and merch. So it's like, well, it's almost like for exposure. They're like, well, we get the exposure on a TV show, But then we have to get people to buy our Blu-rays, which is why you get a lot of like bad anime or even a good anime that's like, well, this is good anime, but if we don't show boobs in this scene that are obscured by Steam that then make people buy a Blu-ray to see the uncensored boobs, then it's not going to make us any money.
There was a dark period in the early aughts is when I sort of got out of anime briefly where every show was like the waifu show. And it's just like every waifu has tens of thousands of dollars of merchandise behind her.
Yes,
so
it's that's why.
Invest in your waifu.
But Netflix doesn't give a shit about that. They're like, no, we're going to do this the way we fund our other shows, which is like, here's the money up front, more than enough to cover it. And so shows that even will air on Japanese TV, they're like, well, we'll be on Japanese Netflix first, then air on Japanese TV, then international Netflix. And the money stream is going differently in their set. And the article goes on that like Netflix is ahead of the curve, but like Amazon, Crunchyroll, all these things. I just think it's funny that 10 years ago, the internet was the biggest enemy of anime in the world, and now its streaming is going to help it, maybe even save it.
It was great. I mean, especially business is slow to change, but especially this is me speaking ignorantly of another culture. I find that through my experience, Japanese business especially, knowing people who worked at Japanese companies, I worked at a Japanese company, they have a very rigid way of doing things and they're reluctant to change. And it took forever for them to embrace streaming. And some companies are still holding on to things when they shouldn't be.
Well, they're even now, I believe the feeling is in Japan, like, not everybody, most people don't have streaming stuff. Like, it's been a problem for one of my favorite wrestling company right now, New Japan Pro Wrestling. They have a streaming service. They're way ahead of the curve, but they have almost more signups outside of Japan than they do in Japan, just because
it's crazy.
Like, people don't think of it like, they'll also get on Roku, guys. Like, what the hell? Like, I don't want to watch it through a website.
We bored you enough, but I want to say, to close out this anime conversation, it is a crime and a sin that you cannot watch Evangelion anywhere. And the last time it was released on DVD was a decade ago. Those are the last releases. Something is going on with that series. It is too popular to not just be over Blu-ray, all over streaming.
Gainax got kind of sued. They're like, wait, you didn't report $1 billion.
That's another thing, but like, if you want to make money, that's a good way to do it.
Yeah, maybe that's why they're also remaking maybe that's why the fourth film will never come out. It's just like, can you believe that they at one time said Evangelion Rebuild would have like, one movie a year, like
a decade ago.
Yeah. And we were lucky to even get third on a Blu-ray in America. It took them like 2 years.
Yeah.
Well, that's also the Japanese business style not really working with the American business style of, we sell this, again, they have to make their main money off of like physical goods.
Yeah, this Blu-ray will be $90.
But you can't sell a Blu-ray for $90 in America. They got to sell it at $20. But if the hardcore fans in Japan know they could import a $20 Blu-ray, then they're not going to buy the $90 one, so you got to wait a year or two. It's unfortunate. And streaming gets around all that bullshit.
Yeah. So this is a preview of what our anime discussions will be like in the future, so I hope you enjoyed it.
Talking about anime with Ian really like made me want to talk more about it.
Mm-hmm.
But okay, the comments.
So do you want to go into first Bart's comments? That was hard for me to read. Let's start with this one. Alex Bullock says, never thought this would be the hill I'd go to die on, but Where's Wally is the original and correct name for Waldo. Not only does it scan better, at least in my accent, Wally is also soft slang for an idiot, similar to Doofus, which fits with his goofy design. Worst episode ever, etc. Winky face. Yes, we Americans know the famous Where's Blank figure as Where's Waldo. I don't know. Is Wally slang for like a dick or something? I don't know why they change it.
I feel like everything you... If anybody said to me, this word in UK slang is a dick, I'd believe it.
It's
same honestly with American slang of just like, I'd call my dick that. Like, yes, I'm sure you would.
I don't see Waldo as an idiot. He seems more like just a happy-go-lucky world traveler who loses his key and his cane and his hat often. But
he's just a... Well, now I wonder if he was meant to be a parody of a European tourist who gets lost places.
That could be it. Yeah, there's got to be that series has to have advanced to an app form or something.
Yeah.
I mean, the original video games for that sucked. Mm-hmm. The NES game, the SNES game, just like, which blob of pixels on this screen is Waldo?
It was a concept made for HD televisions, not for 8-bit pixels.
Gross.
Max Bixler, hello, said, great episode, but I can't believe you skipped over my favorite joke. Arnie in the Sky describes the never think things through attitude of our citizens as he's in a helicopter not flying out of the city. Always a huge laugh out loud for me when I watch this one.
I want to assume he did leave after that broadcast. Yes. I'm also guessing the airport is on the other side of the bridge because why is no one else?
Well, a helicopter could probably land somewhere, right? Yeah. But the joke would be even better if he's like, goodbye, folks. Just flew away.
We're rewriting Simpsons jokes in retrospect. So Patrick Imbeau says, que sera sera. The song always annoys me. As someone who has French as a first language, the fact that this song is always mispronounced is excruciating. It's a French saying, so it's K pronounced que, as opposed to the Spanish K pronounced K.
Oh, is that how French pronounce K? As in the que. Question?
Que.
Que?
Que.
Yeah. Yeah, you took French. I took
Spanish. I did. It took me a minute to actually get that out of my brain's memory banks. Yeah, it's que.
Oh, man, that's weird. I prefer K. I'm on that. K as in queso, cheese.
Que is too like much of a guttural sound to make that up.
Hashizume wrote, some of the buildings around my city from the 40s and 50s still have their fallout shelter signs on the side. It's kind of disconcerting to drive by high school and see a bright red yellow radiation symbol. And also, Mo is really the MVP of this episode, from his horror about his bar getting destroyed to Shelterinis to the barnyard animal impressions.
Oh, God, no.
He steals the show much more than I remembered. Yeah, I wonder, you know, they went from Love and Willie, Groundskeeper Willie, like, now they're out of Love and Willie. They're like, no, it's funny to make Mo say this. Like,
you can put anything in his mouth and make it funny, because he will just say whatever he feels. He's Mo. So, we're going on to critic episode Sherman of Arabia, and Daniel Feit says, in 10 years of living in Japan, I have yet to meet a single Japanese person who even remembers George Bush throwing up on their head of state. I have a hunch that the, quote, Bush is a verb in Japan, unquote, was a thing for 5 minutes in 1992 and then forgotten forever. Japanese comedy is full of one and gone catchphrases and jokes. And that's from Daniel Feit. I got to say, Bush is now more famous for being David Copperfield than for being the guy who threw up broccoli. And man, yes. that scandal just broke. And now a lot of women are coming forward and being like, this guy likes to slap asses.
Wow.
Yeah.
Man. It's funny that within a week of us doing all this stuff about H.W. Bush, then it comes out like, no, he's just a horny old man. A horny old man, or at the very least, this is not excusing it. It's just like, he's old fashioned. He's like, hey, come here. By the way, though, know this about Bush. Like, he had a years long affair with his secretary.
Oh,
like,
my God,
you're
right.
That was a real thing. We talked about it in actually the Mindy episode, The Last Temptation of Homer, when they talk about the affairs, because it was something that came up in the 92 election where it was like, this Jennifer Flowers woman is saying this about Clinton. And the Clinton campaign was like, Bush has openly been having sex with his secretary for years.
Yeah, I mean, this is really going to color the Two Bad Neighbors episode when we do it soon.
Oh, boy, man.
If Bush is still alive, knock on wood.
He's not looking great.
No, but I got to say, it was funny because I forget the name of the actress, but she basically said, oh, yeah, he patted my ass. Mm-hmm. And then afterwards, the Secret Service was like, you shouldn't have been around him. Like, yeah. They were kind of blaming her.
You were within arm's reach of him.
Of a former president. It's very dangerous. And then another tweet came out. It was like, oh, Mr. Bush apologizes. And I was like, oh, that actually somebody apologized. A man in power apologized. That was great. Then the press release came out and was like, you know, he sees this as a form of affection. Some people see it as harassment. Ultimately, who's to say? But we're sorry if you were offended. It was the worst thing to say about sexual harassment. It made me so mad. Like, oh my God, dude. This guy is a gray pile of meat. Just say you're sorry. You don't have very much longer on this earth.
It's in general, people out there, but especially guys like us in this society, we're taught to get away with like a non-apology apology. Like, well, yeah. I'm sorry you were offended, but I definitely didn't mean it that way. But I guess I'm sorry if that's how you felt. Like, that's not an apology. Like, I'd rather you just say nothing. Like, don't even apologize if that's your fucking apology.
That was even on an episode of Rick and Morty recently to show how much of an asshole Rick is, that he says that and then Beth says, and she's like, oh my God, I'm turning into my father.
Yep. Yeah. That episode.
It's a bad episode, though.
We did the last Community one before I watched that episode, and I had been more positive on that season of Rick and Morty, but seeing that joke of like, you've ruined the character of Beth. You've literally turned her into a sociopath within one episode, who murdered other playmates as a kid, and then leave it open that maybe she just abandoned her family to have adventures. Like, you really, it just didn't feel, it did not feel authentic for the Beth character we've seen in all previous episodes.
It felt really unearned, but well, I guess we'll see in season four what happens to Beth.
I'm really getting tired of having to say, like, well, it'll make sense. It's long form storytelling. It'll make sense in the season. Like, will it? And then if it doesn't, can I call you a liar and say, like, no, this shit, like, doesn't. All right.
We'll find out in 2 years.
Sila Chesnokov, forgive me if I mispronounce that, said, Jay's glowing skeleton, due to chemical weapons, was probably meant to refer to the side effects from depleted uranium rounds in Desert Storm. The armor-piercing DU rounds were lightly radioactive, and the subsequent side effects of said radiation were considered to be partial cause of some of the symptoms of what was then called Gulf War Syndrome, higher risk of cancers, and a large spike in birth defects in Iraqi children. Rather than point at any possible wartime impropriety by the U.S., they probably changed the joke rather than draw a government ire. I don't know about that, but I will say, if you're a hard left listener like us, I would definitely say listen to this new podcast I've been listening to, Citations Needed, with an S. They just did a really good podcast about how America stumbles into war.
That's a great podcast. I just heard that episode.
Just the messaging of, like, we're going to be forced into this war. Like, we don't want this, but we're the main military power on Earth. I feel like we can't accidentally get into a war with anybody.
We just have all these weapons. We don't know what to do with them.
Yes. Anyway.
So up next we have, and Maggie Makes Three, and our first comment is from Soapfish, who says, wow, it's like The Simpsons is a show that only passingly cares about continuity when it is relevant to a joke or a nod. Strange for a show where no one ages and exists in the present. And a little tongue-sticking out emoticon follows that sentence. I'm just jabbing, but I really don't understand the need to fixate on identifying a coherent timeline in a show that can't have one due to its nature. And my response to this is, anytime we talk about this stuff, we are kind of playing it up for humor. We're not actually angry about the hair ripping out joke. At least I'm
not. I am
not
a little bit. Well, I'm going to, I will reply to that too. The next comment also kind of goes into that, but we are playing it up a little bit.
Yeah.
It's part of the show and gives us another thing to talk about. Like, we've spent so much time going into these old episodes that it's fun to point out, hey, this episode we watched before contradicts this joke we're just seeing.
Like, it's a self-indulgent way for me to show off all the jokes I've memorized. Yes, like, that joke doesn't mix with that joke.
But yes, David Bednar had a similar two comments here. First off, the commercial break joke isn't that the Simpsons are so trained by TV that they make their own commercials. They've just been inside Homer's imagination, seeing the pictures he tells as a story. Marge's joke sets up the following real-world commercial break as the episode airs as what she's imagining. It's a really nice fourth wall breaker. I like that.
That's my interpretation. It was just there to set up the commercial break, but also this episode, a lot of it is just like the Simpsons are so like in love with TV. They take pictures of the TV, so they can't actually sit through a 22-minute story without taking breaks.
But I do like that whatever commercials you see after that moment are the ones Marge is projecting to you in your brain visually.
Ooh, I don't have that.
But then his second comment is, hey, wait a minute. I hear you, Henry. The stuff with Homer's hair is distinctly contradictory to continuity, but both the events of previous flashback episodes, this episode, and Marge's comment are all stories relayed by narrators and not direct presentations of past events. That is to say, Homer is almost definitely an unreliable narrator, and his presentation of events, though not willfully inaccurate, is probably riddled with omissions and mistakes. He started off telling the kids he fought terrorists, for Pete's sake. So I think it's entirely conceivable that Homer admitted the hair-pulling-out freakouts in prior tellings, and that Marge's correction similarly can have been misremembered staging, but otherwise present a correct vision of the events from her perspective. Where's my no prize? Which is a reference to the Marvel Comics practice of giving out no prizes. But if you really want to go into this, David, Okay, yes, they are always told by a different narrator, but not the same narrator. In I Married Marge, which is the first hair level of Bart's birth, it is told by Homer. So fine, you can say
Marge leaves to go to Dr. Hibbert's.
Yes, so maybe Homer doesn't remember that part, and he remembers his hair at different stages because that's what he wishes his hair looked like then. Fine. Lisa's birth was told by Marge, which within the timeline of the, especially in Maggie Makes Three, Marge's memories are shown as 100% accurate. She is, as far as we can see in the episode, the reliable narrator, as seen in her saying, "Mom, make him tell the story right. That's what really happened." Or her saying, your bottom was a little bigger. Marge's memory is correct. So if she remembers the hair pulling out, then she should have said that when she was telling the story of Lisa's birth, which they all told together in Lisa's first word. So it was not just Homer's the unreliable narrator. Marge and Homer were telling that story. So she would have included that hair pulling out if she would have. So there, boom. That's better. That's more continuity for you.
I don't even want to touch the fact that the Simpsons house borders with the power plant's parking lot. That's a whole other story.
You know, okay, then fine. None of their memories matter. I will totally say, you can say, well, grandpa shouldn't, any grandpa memory shouldn't count because it's grandpa. Like, absolutely. He probably did not, he did not dance for Hitler in the 40s. But when it's Marge, I think you should count on it as a correct memory.
I think Marge remembers correctly. So let's move on to Iron Joe 99, who says, "Cap Bailey, I am deeply offended by your insult to multi-children fam. Actually, I fully agree with your sentiments regarding the extra children problem. My second-born just doesn't get the same level of attention that the first-born did. The benefits of this? She's more self-sufficient. She's less emotionally needy. She plays well on her own, etc. She had less time devoted to her, but that resulted in her being better able to handle things. My first-born is a neurotic mess, comparatively speaking." I can attest to that. I feel like my mom would even attest to this. I am very much more self-sufficient compared to my sister, more independent. I mainly just kept myself busy. I didn't need a lot of attention just because I never really got that much. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's the reason why I do this. Just like I needed to find things to obsess over and things to, you know, take up as hobbies and interests. So doing that made me a mega nerd, and now I'm finally cashing in. So,
and I can identify with a neurotic mess business too.
Oh, yeah, you're one of those firstborns I hear about.
Joe Hodgson, not Joel Hodgson, Joe Hodgson says, "My wife and I had our own Maggie, as in an unexpected pregnancy. Just a family reminder, birth control can fail. For us, it was our second pregnancy and not a third, thankfully. But having a pregnancy you weren't prepared for is pretty overwhelming, especially when your firstborn is only 9 months old when you find out another baby is coming." Whoa. "I used to find it pretty easy to be a cynic over how this episode resolves itself. But it's pretty crazy how quickly your feelings change when your baby does arrive. For us, it was easier, but it was made easier by the fact that we did want another child eventually, just not for a few years. I also didn't have to quit my dream job, but we did have to scramble to get a new house for more than 2 bedrooms, and my wife had to quit her job because 2 kids in daycare is so fucking expensive, it would have basically negated her salary. Unlike Homer, though, I don't keep all the pictures of my daughter at work. She's everywhere in the house, and we just celebrated her first birthday, so I guess everything is working out. If a third comes along, I'll be singing a different tune."
It's a cute story. I like it. I'm glad we didn't offend you.
There was also there were a couple other comments about from parents of who obviously, like, we're all childless, like, so we were hoping for expert opinions from parents on this, so thank you.
Yes, thank you. Next question or comment is from Patrick Imbo, who says, "Regarding acid rain, this was and still is an issue in Sudbury, Ontario, Canada, where I'm from. It's a mining town with huge smokestacks. A while back, it killed the vegetation to the point where NASA would use the rock left over for field training Apollo astronauts."
Oh,
wow.
God.
"It's gotten better, but even to this day, the rain will literally melt the paint on cars. Ugh. The source of the air pollution is so obvious that the mining company, Vail, is required to pay for your car to be repainted." That is astounding. But at least they can bleed those companies dry.
At least that, but yeah. It's so funny.
Sorry, I was put that in negative terms. Those companies deserve to pay people.
No, they absolutely need to.
Look at what's happening in Flint.
Though that's insanity of like, well, the government's not going to stop them from polluting, but we'll make them give you money. Like, it's too, you can't unspill milk kind of feeling.
Yeah, I mean, I come from an industrial town, Youngstown, Ohio, that had a huge steel industry at one time, and everyone talks so fondly of it. But if you go back and look at movies, old movies of the town, like, the skies are just black with pollution, and the entire environment was ruined by that industry. Mm. It's like, it's basically like a Superfund site at this point.
Yeah, it's funny to go back in the 70s, you see these things where they finally, like, were like, oh, pollution's bad, we should stop this, and then they kind of stopped it, and then it just circles back around. Like, eventually the PR of polluters will come around like, okay, we found a way to sneak around and pollute some more. Ah, they caught us. All right. And it's just a repeating 10-year
cycle. The science
cycle.
Is still out on pollution,
I think. It's just, who knows? Who knows? All right. Now to the comments from Sherman, Woman, and Child. Mac Bixler says, after a huge rave in the Itchy and Scratchy Land episode about Bort being the perfect Simpsons bit, I really think the same can be said for the entire Duke is Life scene from The Critic. It's my go-to joke when I'm trying to sell people on the series.
That is great. It has a great payoff, too, because the statue of Duke shouting Duke is Life and then eating a pigeon is funny enough on its own, but then the fact that pigeons are attracted to Duke's voice, not just the statue, is like the very unexpected thing. And the fact that one flies in and he just
indoors,
swallows it. Yeah.
And then he eats it and has no, he coughs slightly. He's like, to swallow an entire pigeon raw.
Maybe that's how he got Duke Phillips disease.
All those pigeons.
It is hereditary, but maybe that triggered it. You never know.
That's true.
So Milton Alamon says, while the country bears are long gone from Disneyland in California, they're actually still kicking at Walt Disney World in Florida and Tokyo Disneyland in Japan. And I have to assume people in Japan have no context for what these things are. Florida, it's like, oh, they're my neighbors.
I've been to Tokyo Disneyland, but the Disney Sea, there's two parts of Tokyo Disneyland. There's Disney Sea and Disneyland. Disneyland recreates all these ones that are in a park that is in America, which is great for the place, but it's like, I didn't fly to Japan to go to a thing that's in California or an imitation of a thing that's in California.
Right.
Disney Sea is more is almost all original. And there's a really cool thing in there where I was going to say, I wonder if the Country Bears sing in English or not there, but I actually went to, they have a jazz review in Disney Sea that is all in English. They do it all in English. And it was this funny feeling that as a privileged American who goes everywhere where everything is for me, when I'm in Japan and I am now a minority, a stranger in a strange land, it was a special feeling to be like, it's all these American people and they're speaking American English to me. Wow. Brian 8 Rude says, for most of my childhood, we were rarely able to get Fox on our TV since we lived out in the middle of nowhere. I missed most of the Simpsons until we got cable and I watched them in syndication. However, I somehow saw most of the Fox season of The Critic when it first aired. Must have been an especially good few months of reception. Man.
Yeah, I mean, I've said this before on our podcast, but in the early seasons of Married with Children, they made a joke about, I mean, every Fox show made a joke about Fox, but whenever the Bundy family had to watch a Fox program, they got into what they called Fox Network viewing positions where they all like held hands. And I think like Bud or Al Bundy held up like a piece of tinfoil.
Yeah.
So it was just like not everyone had a Fox station and some of them were pretty low rent.
I was lucky. We had cable all the time, so I never had to worry about that. Didn't have to worry about it over the air there.
Our next questions are from our comments are from Homer the Great, and this one is from Ben, and he says, as a Mason, not currently affiliated with any lodge, I can tell you that the initiation ritual in the normal lodges, i.e. recognized by a state grand lodge, are pretty benign. Yes, there are blindfolds and sacred oaths, but there is nothing physically painful about the experience. The meeting rituals around the country and in most places around the world, it is also quite standardized, so a traveling Mason will feel at least somewhat at home in any lodge he may travel to. A great episode, by the way. Thank you, Ben.
But that's just the lies that Mason would tell us to throw us off the scent.
Where's the secret pedophilia ring, Ben? You can't hide in your pizza places for long. I don't believe that, by the way.
J.R. Rawls says, Abe Simpson is a horrible, horrible father. That's not up for debate. If we're looking at him as a character, though, it's important to remember that part of the reason why he is a horrible father is probably because not only was Homer an unwanted child, but then his wife left him and he was forced to raise that unwanted child as a single parent. That's a rough, rough life position to be in.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. I could see that. And also that though Abe was so horrible, he could never get another, like even in the 60s, when you would think women would be more ready to be like, well, he does have a job. I guess I'll marry this guy. Like,
that is,
he never got a stepwife. You know,
yeah.
That's one thing they could have explored in some flashbacks of like Abe dating, Abe trying to get back on the dating.
Like in the
thing.
70s.
Yeah, in the early 70s, though I guess now it would be the. That was a really depressing thought that Bill Oakley brought up. He's like, well, Grandpa would be dead now. Like, there are no grandpas aren't like Abe anymore.
We haven't gotten to Mother Simpson yet, but I feel like they do a pretty good job of making her into a good woman, despite the fact that she left her family. But now I'm thinking, what's worse, to abandon your son or to have an abusive father raise him? Is what's worse there?
Yeah.
I mean, because she kind of caused the, like, she was the force of good in Homer's life. I guess we'll talk more about it.
Yeah, they did set up that she had, they give an excuse of like, well, she had to run away.
Yeah.
The cops were after her, and so better to think she's dead than a criminal, though. The Abe saying she died at the movies, there's no funeral. It's like, that might be the worst thing he's ever done.
I'm going to cry during that episode, I swear, when I watch it again. I always do. So the next question is from Joel Dreyer, who says, this episode is the proving one to me. John Swartzwelder is my all-time favorite Simpsons writer. Understanding his voice and how his jokes took shape in the show has made my revisiting of the show great. I have to get around to reading his books. Yeah, I recommend them. I've only read one of them because they started coming out when I was in grad school and had no money, and they were like $15 each in 100 pages.
Well,
because
they were from a boutique house,
right.
Publishing house.
I think they're all on Kindle now, but
I believe
They're just like, they're all great John Swartzwelder style jokes about detectives and cowboys and every old-timey thing he loves.
All these Frank Burley mysteries are great. I've read about five of them. They're all tons of fun. Basically, Frank Burley is Homer with no family and not encumbered by that, by needing a sitcom wrap-up. So
that's true.
In one book, Frank Burley is taken over by Martians and then is tricked into being a Martian and then conquers the planet as the leader of the Martians. And then somehow they step it back from there. And
I only read the Time Machine did it, which was really good.
That's a great
one.
It's
the first one.
I believe Matt Groening on a commentary brings up a great opening line of like, I was blocking this punch with the fat in my stomach. Okay. And man, we'll probably look forward next week. Homie the Clown. Probably the best John Swartzwelder written episode ever. Maybe the
most
funniest
we laughed
episode
on an episode, and there's eight lines of the show, I think.
If you love hearing us laugh to ourselves self-satisfiedly. Jacob Morris said, it's nothing major, but I noticed two little animation jokes in the episode. When Homer gets the roller skates, his license plate reads R8DNT, which I assume is supposed to mean radiant, and that the plate on the green car he supports himself with has ANIM8R, like animator. It's not really important, but I just thought it was neat.
I assume those were
neat.
Snuck in by the artists as like, and they graffito tagged that episode.
I like when on the commentaries, a writer will be like, that background character is so specific, it has to be an animator's girlfriend or something, or the animator himself.
So our next episode is Fear of Flying, and the first comment is from Daniel Fight again, who says, as someone who watches every Simpsons since the show debuted, I remember this was the first episode that felt off to me, like the spirit of the show was changing. In hindsight, all the signs are there. Loads of guest stars, a first act that only serves to get a completely different rest of the episode, a premise that hinges on ignoring past episodes. Marge and the family have absolutely flown before. I'm not saying it's the worst episode or the last one I watched new. I stuck with The Simpsons for many more years. It was just the first time I noticed the show wasn't the same anymore. Yes.
I think that's a good point, especially those real specific things are like, those were the patterns that turned me off to the show in, you know, season 12-ish, that when I finally was like, I just can't anymore.
This kind of feels like something I was talking about on Twitter yesterday, like revisiting The Critic. I still love it, but I'm seeing a lot of the same problems I saw in Al Jean and Mike Reiss's work, where it's just like, there are too many stories in an episode and they're barely related and they have to get out of the way of each other and then just end abruptly. And I feel like they didn't work on this season, but Fear of Flying feels like an Al Jean and Mike Reiss episode where there's just like these two stories and one doesn't get enough attention. It's even more like, I think we mentioned it during the recording, it's more like Bart's Inner Child, where there's a more important issue that's ignored for silliness.
And I think it was a freelancer script, too.
Yeah,
so
that's true.
I think
David Sachs.
I could see Merkin, his showrunner, and the rest of the team are like, you know what? We got Bart's Comet and Homie the Clown coming up. Why don't we just take it easy on this one? Like, this doesn't need hyper rewrites. If Bart's Comet and Homie the Clown got more attention and ended up being better episodes of the sacrifice of this episode, then that's all right with
me. They're really good. And I think it's not a bad episode, just kind of weak compared to what's surrounding it. Same with Bart's Inner Child.
Solomon Mars also was not a fan of this episode, says, sigh, I'm all for Marge character development, but I've always hated this episode. I just don't understand why her father doing a job even in the 60s would traumatize her. I just always thought of this as a bad episode and Guy Incognito can't save it. Marge is a tragedy sponge and I hate the way she's always been written / underwritten. Sorry to use the word hate so much. There's only one episode that I truly hate, and y'all will know it by my long text wall tirade. Void, which I
looking forward to that.
I wonder what episode that will be.
Hopefully, it's not soon.
But yeah, I think Marge gets underserved in this episode. But I think the reasons that's traumatic is because if it was an actual traumatic event, it would have colored her history and future character stuff too much. I think they're like, well, her father can't have actually like even been like verbally abusive or personally abusive or anything like that. Or she can't have like even unrelated to her family, like seen a dead body or something or any. It couldn't be anything truly scarring right. for her. It would have gone too dark, you know, and that's the kind of stuff Matt Groening really protected against, too. He's like didn't want to sell out the characters in that way, I think.
Mm-hmm. So this one is from Austin Rowland, and it says, as someone who is a big fan of both The Simpsons and early seasons of SpongeBob, it always slightly bothered me that the SpongeBob episode No Weenies Allowed contains a joke nearly identical to the Guy Incognito bit. In the episode, SpongeBob is denied entrance to a restaurant/bar for tough fish called the Salty Spittoon. He is then told that he should try wearing a disguise to gain entry. And in the following scene, we see a drifter that looks identical to SpongeBob, but with black hair. The entrance guard thinks that it's SpongeBob wearing a wig and tries to pull the hair off, but then the real SpongeBob approaches wearing a rainbow clown wig. I know this is a random observation, but I always wondered whether or not the similarity of the joke was intentional.
Yeah, I wonder too that that tough guy, that episode is one of my favorites of the SpongeBob run, the Hillenburg run of SpongeBob. I kind of stopped watching the show with any regularity after the movie because that really was the finale of the Hillenburg years of the show. But that one was really funny. It has the one of SpongeBob trying to act tough, like he cracks his knuckles and breaks all his fingers all when right. he does it. He has a bit where he says, like, well, I stubbed my toe while working in my herb garden yesterday, and I only cried for 10 minutes. But yes, it's exactly the Guy Incognito joke.
I assume it's lateral thinking. It's just a subversion yeah. of the, you know, disguising yourself sort of trope.
I would think the SpongeBob animators probably watched The Simpsons.
Probably.
And that joke was just floating around there. Few jokes are original.
It's true. Yeah. But I mean, I'll go back and I'll read like an old Something Awful article I wrote 6 years ago. I was like, that joke is awfully similar to something I'd seen before. And my brain didn't realize it at the time. Just like, this is brilliant.
No, yeah. Oh, John Brandon, who also took me a little to task on this on Twitter, but I understand my bear brother that I did let down the Weather Girls with underreporting on them. So he had some extra facts on the singers of It's Raining Men. As a big fan of the Weather Girls, Chris was right. Originally called Two Tons of Fun until the release of this song, I've got a few things to add. Unsurprisingly, I'm quite a homosexual. Number one, Paul Schaefer wrote this song. Do not question his sexuality. Number two, Martha Wash, one of the two original Weather Girls, is still very much alive. She was the one singing Everybody Dance Now on the CNC Music Factory.
She's always standing in front of a giant fan.
Yes, which we will hear that in Homer's Phobia.
Oh, yeah.
And third, if you enjoy this song, can I recommend Dear Sexy Ghost, a sexy Halloween song, or Dear Santa, Bring Me a Man, their sexy Christmas song. Oh, they also have a great song about their continuing success called Success, which name drops all the gay bars they played in during the 80s. Wow, that's, I love that they were so like, well, can we do It's Raining Christmas or It's Raining Halloween?
Like, that's amazing. I feel like the 80s were the last time you could define yourself by your size as an artist. I mean, yeah. The Notorious B.I.G. start in the 80s, he had to have, right?
Made about late 80s. Yeah. Like, yeah. But the,
I'm insane, thinking Fat the Boys, Fat Boys. Yeah.
And yeah, there were lots of, there are lots of heavy singers. I just do love that they're like, well, we had one hit. Like, it, though, if you can make it, actually, in the Colbert Report Christmas special, he has an entire song about, I have to make a Christmas standard. If I can, I am rich for life.
That's a great special.
I never
special.
Have to do anything again.
Yeah. Yes. I have to say, we were watching the Fat Boys song or video, Are You Ready for Freddy? It's the tie-in mm-hmm. to one of the Nightmare on Elm Street movies. Chris was making us watch it. He forced us to watch it. It was fun. But we were talking, it's like, you know, by modern standards, one of these fat boys is just kind of paunchy. It's just yeah. like the moderately chubby boy.
In the 80s, fat was a little different than it is now.
So the next comment comes from Joseph Rush, who says, I'm a pilot in the Air Force, so the first half of this episode has a special place in my heart and daily lexicon. I'll always hover my hand over certain switches in the aircraft and say to myself, We need that to live. Also, being out of Northern California, we'll always fly to Alaska and Hawaii, the freak states. Thank you for your service, great. Joseph.
Someone else shared a comment about, like, no, alcoholism in pilots is actually a very big thing. And he shared an article on, like, ooh, this is bad, like, percentage-wise higher than others. Allison says, I'm appreciative of Henry making the effort to dispel the incorrect adage of how Chinese use the same word for opportunity crisis. Without going too much in depth, it is essentially correct that the last character of crisis, and then the Chinese characters are in the text, is the first character of opportunity, and the Chinese characters again in text. But the character is though on its own does not mean either. It actually means machine. Chinese is very much a metaphorical language, so we tend to create new words by putting old characters in new combinations together. We don't have letters. One final thing is that Cantonese and Mandarin are the main spoken dialects, which are very different, but we read and write the same Chinese language. Huh. Where there are, of course, regional variations of certain terminology, but for the most part, we can understand each other in writing. Now that goes into a newer debate of simplified versus traditional versus opinion Chinese, but that's for another time. So thank you for the Chinese expertise there.
I have a minor in linguistics, so I find all this very fascinating.
That is really, man, that they all, that Mandarin and Cantonese are so different, but they all read the same language.
Yeah.
And yeah, that the shared letter is machine. So thank you. My research is good, but it cannot replace somebody who speaks the language.
But Lisa Simpson was wrong, everybody. Not as smart as she thinks.
That's our last one.
Yeah, yeah. So thank you so much for listening and giving us money. Anything else to mention? I mean, we're working hard on Talking Critic. Mm-hmm. That's been going great. It'll be ending, wrapping up probably this year, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I thank all of you for all your comments, too, on the Patreon, and also, you know, tell a friend, I guess. And I guess, yeah, too, there was a thing where, like, there were some unsubscribing stuff from Apple Podcasts changing. So I don't know. You guys, if you're listening to this, then you subscribe.
Yeah, but, like, you know what you're doing. But, yeah,
but tell your friend, I guess.
Yeah, tell your friend to stop using the iOS podcast app because it's bad. Stop using iTunes. I've said on a podcast before, there are lots of great podcatchers. My recommendation is Downcast. It's $3, and that is $3 well spent. Mm-hmm. The best $3 I've ever spent for the thousands of hours I spend listening to podcasts every year. So
yeah, and I use the free version of Overcast, which has been really good for me. I should maybe switch to Downcast, but I'm too old to learn something new.
How much is that paid version?
I don't know. Might have been $5, or maybe there is no paid version.
Oh.
The ads are real small on it. It's easy to ignore. But yeah, that's where I listen to this and all these other ones and all my other podcasts. But
and I guess one last thing I'll say, and I assume a lot of people listening have done this, but if you could leave us a review in the iTunes music store, that'd be great.
I think it's just called Apple Podcasts.
Apple Podcasts. I mean, for as much as I hate iTunes, I think it's been bad for years, that is still the standard of for podcast reviews. But
and reviews help with discoverability. People will find it the more reviews there are, especially obviously positive ones. I think we've been helped a lot of just, like, people are like, I want a Simpsons podcast. That's how great friend of the show Eric Nagel discovered us, that he was just like, I want a Simpsons podcast. All of these are awful. Oh, wait, this one, I remember he talked about, I won't name it, but he talked about one podcast, like, sounds like they're recording around a toilet. Like, this is terrible.
We're recording near a toilet, not around a toilet.
We were within 6 feet of a toilet. If you could go through walls.
Yes, and I won't, but we've been getting some, like, really cranky reviews where it's just like, I can't do anything. I mean, I believe in freedom of speech above all things, Henry, but I can't do anything with the criticism they're giving me. Just like, well, I don't think this is true at all. So I like
I'm not going to stop being me.
Yeah.
They're like, I'm sorry, I'm super lefty now, but this election fucking broke my brain. Just tell yourself that.
I'll tell you, I won't go too far into this, but fans of a certain online crank, the second thing they do is go to the iTunes Music Store and give us negative reviews. So if you could give us some positive ones to combat that, that'd be great. They're not written in good faith, so I'm just like, well, I don't like these at all. So
you've never listened to this show.
No,
I know, you just showed up. There's a certain, you can tell when the spikes happen too, of like, oh yeah, was something happened on Twitter at the time this review? Anyway,
too
I
much
guess
politics.
That's it.
Yes, thank you so much for listening, folks. We'll see you next month for another episode of Talk to the Audience. Thank you for listening.
infotainment.